Price, and this is Price Talks, the conversation of the Price Tags blog. Check it out, pricetags.ca. I'm with Chris Fair, who has possibly one of the best jobs in the world. Or do I exaggerate?
I don't think so. I certainly, for myself personally, it is the best job in the world.
What do you do?
I'm president of Resonance Consultancy, a firm based here in Vancouver in New York. And we work with places, whether they be countries, cities, or communities, to help them think about the future. Whether that's creating a new mixed-use development as a resort, urban revitalization, or helping a community, city, country, island think about tourism, talent attraction, economic development. It seems like a wide variety of things, but they're all interrelated with respect to helping places of all kinds realize their full economic potential.
You front-load the creativity.
Absolutely. Our background and my history and the start of our firm was as a branding and marketing agency, and that still is a big part of what we do. Over time, we realized, though, that just the branding and marketing of place wasn't enough alone to realize its future success, and over time, we developed more and more deeper diving into strategy, research, planning, and methods to think about how to make places successful.
I'm trying to think of what you actually do. You go to a place, and then people are going to expect magic from you. They're going to expect brilliant insights. A lot of pressure. You must have a technique.
We've developed our own approaches and methodologies to thinking about place. You know, just coming at this as an outsider, so to speak, not having an architecture planning background per se, coming at it more from a marketing perspective, and my education and studies of the future was much more forward-looking.
Oh, studies of the future. I think we may get there. But before we do, I want to go back a little further. I think before architecture, you went to the University of Victoria for...
Started out in creative writing.
Creative writing.
Grew up in Calgary, went to University of Victoria.
Hold it there. Creative writing program. Why would someone get into creative writing?
Because they thought they wanted to be a writer, obviously. But pretty quickly realizing I wasn't going to write the next great novel. My attention and interests were also more nonfiction focused and investigative in journalism.
Did you start a novel?
I didn't, no. But always focused in working at the university newspapers and that, and that led me to the journalism program at Concordia University.
We've ran into this with several of the people we've interviewed. They've started with some sense of wanting, having to be creative, to have a job that was creative. And I'm assuming the same has always been true for you.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, whether that's writing or strategy, it is always about some creative output.
And yet you get very much into corporate and governmental structures, call them bureaucracies, not what you would think of necessarily creative places.
No, and that's why they turn to outside consultants like us when they're looking for that injection of creativity or alternative approaches to research or thinking. So that is... That's part of the fun part of being able to go in and disrupt some of those organizations.
Disrupt. Where are you from?
Grew up in Calgary and went to University of Victoria, as we just mentioned, then did my bachelor's degree at Concordia University in journalism in Montreal.
What year did you graduate?
I graduated in 1993.
All right. So we're going into the 90s.
Yes.
Where do you end up?
As I was finishing my bachelor's degree in journalism at Concordia in Montreal, Interwest, which was a Vancouver company that was developing Blackcomb and Whistler at the time, acquired a ski resort called Mont Tremblant. And as I heard about this and saw their goals and ambitions, and having been to Whistler in the late 80s, early 90s, and what had happened there, saw an opportunity to move to Tremblant and start the first English media. There was no English communications, and if we were going to attract all of these American visitors that they were talking about, figured there was an opportunity to create a new bilingual newspaper that would talk to tourists and visitors in the area.
So I'm guessing that you do translate contemporary lifestyles or what's coming in a way that a corporation can get their head around and invest in. And you, I'm guessing, just guessing, have kind of pursued places that provide you with the kind of lifestyle you want to lead as well. I'm thinking you're coming out, you're graduating, you see a ski resort. This seems to fit.
Yeah, I loved to ski and snowboard at the time, and that certainly fit my lifestyle in terms of looking at travel. And so, yeah, trying to marry personal interests and ambition together, and that was a great place to do it.
Do you get bored fast?
Absolutely. I call my wife and I joke that I have a geographic attention deficit disorder, so I can't spend too much time in one place. So I've spent the last 25 years basically traveling more than 150 days a year.
Okay, let's back to Montreal, Mount Tremblant.
Sure.
Where from there?
When I was at Mont Tremblant, I quickly realized that IntraWest was making a lot more money selling real estate and condominiums at the resort than I was making selling advertising in my newspaper. So we pivoted a little bit and created a branding marketing agency and eventually became IntraWest's marketing agency of record for all of their real estate developments in Eastern North America as they expanded into the U.S. in Vermont and Florida and eventually Les Arcs in France.
But you didn't get into real estate.
Not specifically. So it was really around the branding and marketing of real estate, of looking at how do you take these buildings and build a story around the lifestyle, marrying those two together that would attract prospective investors and buyers from all over the world.
Nonetheless, you needed a good understanding of the reality of real estate, how all of that, how those pro formas work.
Absolutely, although I didn't have that going in. So that was one of the classic, you know, fake it until you make it strategies of being able to wing your way through that. But also not having any of that experience, we came up with new and novel ways because we were, you know, didn't know what we didn't know and approached it.
By the way, were you just giving life advice to younger people there?
I guess so.
Fake
Maybe
it.
I finally reached that moment where my experience is actually can be shared with people.
It's work for you.
Yes, absolutely.
Absolutely. Okay, so where are we off to?
Well, I was in Mont Tremblant then, and you know, our creative agency was growing. We opened an office in Montreal, but at that point in time, real estate was booming in the late 90s, and particularly in the resort sector area. And one of our clients asked me to move to Greenville, South Carolina, to start an in-house creative department for them. And I packed up and was in the midst of working on my master's degree. I had just finished 6 weeks in Houston. And
oh, Houston as well.
Yeah, it was through the Studies of the Future program at Houston, and packed up. Instead of going back to Mont Tremblant, I went to Greenville, South Carolina.
So Canadian boy, prairie boy, ends up in the American, well, American South, but the booming South of the 90s. What's the big difference?
I mean, obviously there's cultural differences.
Tell me more.
In terms of, particularly in South Carolina, you know, a lot of social fabric is woven around the church. So not being a churchgoer myself, you're a little bit left out. Really easy to get golf tee times, though, on Sundays. So that tended to be a lot of my social activity. But fascinating to look at. In particular, Greenville is a city I hold up today as one of the most interesting revitalizations of a downtown in the world.
Never heard of this. Greenville, South Carolina.
Absolutely. So for a period of time in the late 90s, well, when I was first moving there, you know, Greenville was formerly the textile capital of the world. It was a booming industrial city in the 60s, but in the 70s, that entire industry moved to Asia. So all the textile mills closed, and Greenville went into a downward spiral. Most of the downtown in the 80s was completely boarded up. And visionary city council mayor at the time decided that if they were going to attract investment to the city, they were going to have to focus and beautify their downtown. They removed two lanes for cars, turned it to parking, so it became a two-lane street. Planted hundreds of trees, invested in an art center. So I was moving there just at that time while this transition was starting to take root. It had been a long, long period of time, but it led to both Michelin and BMW choosing Greenville area as their North American headquarters. So today, if you drive any BMW X Series car, it's manufactured in Greenville, South Carolina. Not only here, but if you drive an X Series car in Germany, it was also manufactured in South Carolina. So there was a period of time there where that area was receiving more foreign direct investment per capita than any county in the United States. And it continues to attract investment from all over the world.
Because they got a nice downtown.
That's, if you ask the mayor Knox White today, they would absolutely say it was because of the downtown, that if that had not, if those investments weren't made, then that investment could have easily gone to some other boarded up town. Of course, there were other incentives, taxes, regulations around unions, all of these things that were made that part of the country attractive. But why Greenville specifically, related to the downtown?
So this mayor, was he what we'd now call a new urbanist?
Yeah.
Did he actually have a vision or an ideology?
Yeah, I think they were really ahead of their time in terms of embracing that idea. And of course, you look at it today and everybody would like to replicate that. success, but realizing that that was a 20, 30-year journey, that it wasn't an overnight success story, is important to acknowledge.
Did the mayor, without ever saying it, or do you think it's appropriate to say that they wanted to be more of a resort, that they wanted a guy who actually did have understanding of what makes those places work?
No, I don't think resort was on their mind, and I wasn't working directly with Greenville at the time. I was actually working on a lot of resort developments for a company based in Greenville. So it was just interesting that we were able to kind of observe and be part of that renaissance as it was happening, even though I wasn't directly working on it.
Do you bring a resort sensibility, though, to these places?
I wouldn't call it a resort sensibility. I mean, I think our approach to thinking about places is morally more around lifestyle and how do people behave, what types of experiences resonate with people. And that's why we called our company Resonance. I'm always struck by when we work with architects and planners that a lot of their work and their view is based on historical precedent of what places have been. And they're actually not very driven by how people actually behave, or more importantly, how do people want to behave in the future? And that's really the lens that we bring. And so I think there is that tie-in from going back to a lifetime of experience with resorts, of thinking about how people have fun, how people have experiences together. Well, how does that then translate into the kind of products and buildings that we should be in, places that we should be creating?
Vancouver is often criticized as being more of a resort city than a real place. Is that so bad?
Well, I think there's two things there. I think, A, I don't agree that it's a resort city. If it was, we wouldn't have 4 million square feet of Class A office space currently under construction in the city. So there are a lot of things happening in Vancouver. It's always been a desirable place. I would characterize it as a lifestyle city. It does have great experiences, activities that you might think of as having some things in common with a resort. But the economy here is fundamentally different than that of a resort community.
Is it so bad for cities to be more like resorts?
Not in the sense in terms of quality of life and experiences. I think absolutely that
seems to me that's what you were just saying. People want to be places where they can have fun, and I think assume all the other things like a real economy, jobs. But if the city does feel more like a resort, is that in itself, I think by asking the question you can tell where I'm going, a bad thing?
No, not at all. I mean, I think that's actually an incredible asset as we look at the things that drive talent, investment, and tourism. It is all of those. There's an increasingly tightly knit series of factors that are closely related between what makes a place attractive to visit versus what makes it attractive to live, and also what makes it attractive to invest.
Do they end up being places, though, for the rich or just even people who really have the options to afford to be able to select the place they want to live in?
There's no question that with globalization and the increasing fluidity of capital and people around the world, that they are migrating to those places that offer exceptional quality of life and lifestyle, like a Vancouver, or a Sydney, which creates upward pressure on prices. And that's where a resort, if it was a true resort city, is a city that does just become exclusive, that begins to look like an Aspen does. Our challenge is how do we marry that lifestyle with economic opportunity and ensure that we're not just developing quality of life, but also developing the quality of our economy and the jobs and incomes that go with those to ensure that it's a city that's accessible to all.
It's that easy.
If only. I mean, I think this is a new frontier that not many cities have had to experience. If you think back, 25 years ago, the fluidity of people moving around the world was not near what it is today. But today, with technology, talent can choose to live anywhere it wants. I moved here from New York at the time, but we could have moved to and easily built this company in Copenhagen or in somewhere in Southern California.
Skiing. We had skiing.
That was top of my list. I would tell people our entire business strategy was driven by proximity to Whistler. So,
you are one of the people who can. You have choices. You have the income to support those choices, and you go to places and tell them how they can be more like this.
In some cases, there's not a one-size-fits-all solution. I mean, Vancouver is difficult to replicate. So there's also thinking about other places like. And we were just talking about Greenville, South Carolina, completely different kind of place, but also equally prosperous. So there's not a one-size-fits-all solution as we go from one town or city or resort or place to another. We're always looking at what's the economic opportunity and what's the right strategy for that particular place.
Darn it, Chris, I'm just trying to pigeonhole you here. But listen, this is the number one issue, and you hear it now, people actually saying, you know, we shouldn't be providing more and more amenity. We shouldn't try. In fact, we have to really discourage people from coming here by making it less attractive.
I'm not sure what the thought process behind that is. I mean, I don't think we should.
Well, so that there's room for people who will still be able to afford it way down the scale, like they used to be, or at least they believe they used to be able to.
So I think there is a question mark of what should we be prioritizing in terms of public amenities and institutions, infrastructure, that it isn't just focused on those elite exclusive type experiences or experiences and amenities that might just be attractive to the wealthiest people, wealthiest segment of the population. So maybe it is a question of shifting resources, but I don't think we should ever be thinking or that we should be trying to make a place less attractive.
What about attracting better jobs, more companies? What about the question of incentives? We see Amazon most recently. Do cities have to do something to attract the jobs that they want to support their tax base, the quality of life that you will consult and tell them what to do?
Well, certainly in the U.S., that has been the operating principle for most economic development organizations, is offering incentives or tax breaks to be able to attract corporate relocation. I think what's happened with the Amazon HQ2 in New York is, you know, is a great example of maybe as the public can the community starting to reject that premise and that notion that we should be subsidizing to attract jobs to a great urban environment.
And what would you advise?
I mean, in that case, we actually did an examination of the, you know, Amazon HQ2 bid and looked at all their criteria to predict using our best cities rankings and data which location they would choose, and New York was number one. Interestingly, though, Toronto was number two in our benchmarking, but we said flat out that Toronto wouldn't get the HQ2 headquarters, not because it didn't meet the criteria, but because it wasn't offering the incentives and it wasn't willing to play that game. I think hopefully more and more cities will follow suit with that, and what's happened with the rejection of Amazon HQ2 in New York is maybe a good sign that cities will start to think less about offering outright incentives and think more about investing in quality of infrastructure, amenities, experiences for their local citizens that thereby then attract talent and thereby then attract companies that follow.
Given what happened, that there was a blowback to the New York proposal, Amazon pulled, and now you feel that there's a real political, even cultural difference. Are we going to see more of that?
A cultural difference between?
Well, let's go back to the premise here. Do cities have to have incentives, tax breaks, whatever you call it, infrastructure agreements, to attract the kind of jobs that they need? And while you said, I think, that they shouldn't have to, maybe they still do. If the blowback in New York is an indication, maybe that's politically less, more questionable now as well. I'm really just wondering where we stand on this. Let's go back to the question, what would you advise a city to do?
I mean, it depends on their particular circumstances. You know, I think cities like Vancouver, Toronto, New York don't need to be offering incentives, that they've made huge investments in institutions, whether educational experiences, et cetera, so that those types of cities may not and shouldn't be offering incentives. You know, there may be particular cases that if you're in, you know, Oklahoma, a city like Tulsa that we work with, that you might still have to consider some of those incentives to be early on to bring in a company that could be a catalyst for attracting other companies and investments. So I don't think it's, again, a one-size-fits-all answer that we should say there's no purpose or point to incentives at all. I think in certain cities that's true, and others it may not.
But not Vancouver?
Yeah, no, certainly in the case of Vancouver or Toronto, you know, I don't think that's the business that we're in, and we're not, frankly. Vancouver's not offering, and British Columbia, other than things like film credits and some of those tax incentives, which are, you know, questionable also. Should we continue to offer? Do we need to continue to offer those based on the strength of the talent, the setting that we have here? And should Vancouver be able to stand on its own? Of course, it's competing with other cities, and it becomes a question of who's willing to blink first and take a stand on that.
How long were you in New York?
New York, only 2 years. My daughter was born there. just at the before the Great Recession, so to speak. So we were living just a few blocks from Wall Street as everything was unraveling. Fortunately, we were quite distracted with the starting a new family. But as that settled in and continued to be, most of our opportunity was in the Western U.S. and Calgary, actually. It just made more sense that, and moving to Vancouver had always been something on my list as a place if I could choose anywhere that I wanted to live, and we decided to move here in 2010.
If you had the option, would you go back and live in New York?
Yeah, absolutely. And I still go back to New York 10 times a year at least for various meetings and projects that we have going there. And in the future, I would certainly consider living in New York in terms of raising a family and the balance of those things. You know, Vancouver was by far the best place in the world that that I could think of.
What do you like best about New York?
New York is really just the collision of people in terms of the talent that's there, of different interests, and the density of people you can meet with, work with, talk with. I think that's probably one of the most fascinating things about New York, is just that it's an international crossroads. And Vancouver is becoming more and more like that, but just on a smaller scale.
Isn't the world?
It is in certain places, right? Like talent and ideas are clustering, whether that's in Copenhagen or it's in New York or it's in Vancouver or Sydney or in Hong Kong. But there are places that are not clustering and attracting talent. And I think that is going to be one of our greatest challenges in the 21st century, is going to be that bifurcation of success, where some places are winning and some places are not. Even in when times are tough, some of these superstar cities will continue to succeed, while others will fall further behind.
I think of New York as the great city of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. The best architecture, culture, Broadway, thinking, even Wall Street, politics. Well, so many things, New York. But will it be what will actually be the great city of the 21st century? I doubt it will be New York.
No, I think, you know, we look at the cities like London's and Tokyo's and Paris's and New York's that are these very successful so-called superstar cities. And that is a great question to ask of, you know, what will the superstar cities of the 21st century be? Certainly, they're more likely to be in Asia, you know, where we see the biggest investments and influx of capital and talent and development around the world. But within a North American context, I think Vancouver has that opportunity to potentially be one of the cities that we'll look at as one of the winners and best-in-class examples in the 21st century within a North American context.
We're in a library. When this library was built, there was an open question as to whether we would need them. A place for books? Paper? But here we are, because there's so much else happening. Is that true for cities as well? The debate has been in a digital age. You don't really need to cluster, except for meetings and entertainment and culture, sure. But generally, as far as work and the places we will live, that idea of the city is so 20th century. What's 21st?
Well, I think there still is a need to cluster for ideas, and creativity doesn't happen in isolation. And more of our workforce today is working independently, you know, whether that's freelance or their own small companies. And places like libraries create that opportunity to cluster people together. You know, like ourselves here, we're not here for the books today, but we're here doing a podcast out of the Vancouver Public Library. And certainly when this place was built at that time, this idea wouldn't have even been envisioned. So
what's a podcast?
Exactly. So the question is really about how are we creating centers or clusters for creativity and community.
So how do you find out ahead of the time? How do you find out the next creative place before it's the next creative place?
I mean, I think within the context of planning for the city, that we can't necessarily anticipate exactly what those outcomes or specific ways we'll be using technology might be. What we can acknowledge is the need and desire of people to gather together, to work together, to cluster together. So how do we create opportunities for that are flexible, I think, is probably one of the biggest things as we think about and working on new commercial campuses and buildings. That is the key mantra of looking at how do we make this place flexible, because we can't possibly anticipate how people might work together in 20 years, but we know they'll be working together in some way. So let's design buildings to ensure that they can can adapt to the way we might work and live in the future.
Got a good example here?
I think once an example of a project here in Vancouver that's quite interesting is the redevelopment of the post office. You know, of course, you couldn't have ever anticipated when that place was built in the 1960s, it was one of the largest steel structures in North America at the time, that that postal facility, really a factory for the mail, would eventually transform itself into a campus for Amazon. With the redevelopment of that building, of looking at the floor plates that Quadreal is putting in for that campus for Amazon, or, you know, very open, very flexible, so that they could be divided up or reassembled. But starting with that open, column-free floor plate as much as possible creates the ability for who knows what might become in the future.
Amazon might describe itself as a data company. Maybe most firms would now. What's your source? How do you use data?
Yeah, data and big so-called big data is kind of bantied about as the source of all competitive advantage. For our company, we've really looked at that and coming at this again, just like with the looking at the resort real estate industry in the 90s and not knowing what we didn't know, we came at thinking about the future and planning of places and looking at how do you benchmark and identify what a place's comparative strengths and weaknesses are from an experiential perspective. We first approached this in Ireland, where we were working for the national government there on a development strategy for the south and east of the country. And then we asked, well, what are assets of all the experiences you have? And they gave us a map with more than 1,000 items on that map. And we said, well, how do we determine which ones are important to international visitors? And that's where we developed the idea that I thought about using user-generated data of going into channels like TripAdvisor to see which of these experiences are people recommending and to what intensity. So that was our first adventure into mining data.
When did you do that?
That would have been about 6 years ago. And so since that time, from that first experience, we started to refine that approach and methodology of thinking about, okay, we could do this for cities or we could do this for neighborhoods, of going into not just channels like TripAdvisor, but also things like Yelp, to be able to quantify how many very good and excellent experiences are there within one particular city or another. And not just looking at experiential data, but we're also looking at core statistics on things like crime and safety, those things that we all know are important. But what we've learned is that it's actually the experiential characteristics or the vibrancy of the city that's even more important than safety and housing affordability. And those things that we consider to be table stakes are not necessarily the things that have the highest correlation with attracting visitors, talent, or investment.
Yelp is a city planning tool.
Absolutely.
That's what you're telling me.
Yeah.
It seems so obvious. Were you the first to do it?
To our knowledge, yes, and we've applied for a patent in the U.S. and Canada for our methodology now to not only scraping that data, but then also mapping it, GIS mapping it, to be able to create an experiential map of the city to look at and visualize how do locals consume culture within a city, where are the nodes, and how do we maybe look at how we create corridors or link up some of these clusters of experiences within a city. So that is a great planning tool.
So when you got some of the results, was any of it revelatory? Were you surprised or amused by something that you didn't expect?
Yeah, I think the most revelation came out of when we started to take all that data, where we now are collecting and updating every year for more than 300 cities around the world, and started to analyze the correlation between some of these performance scores with the factors that had the highest correlation with investment by foreign companies in a city, and also arrivals of visitors. And when you look at arrivals with visitors, it wasn't surprising that you see things like the number of TripAdvisor reviews or Instagram mentions. You would expect those to have a very strong correlation, and they do. The surprises really came out when we looked at the correlation between these experiential factors and the number of jobs in foreign owned enterprises from one city to the next. And you think things like number of Fortune 500 companies, very strong correlation, no surprise there. But interestingly, a city's Google Trend score had an even higher correlation with the number of jobs in foreign-owned enterprises. So, you know, obviously the Google Trend score isn't causing investment, but that buzz around the city, and if searches or search volume is going up for the city, well, so is investment. So at least that probably makes sense, but now we're able to document that. And then we're looking at other things like actually the number of professional sports teams in a city has a very high correlation. So trying to identify where these relationships are with the outcomes that we're trying to achieve is really, really our goal. And we don't have all the answers yet, but we're uncovering some surprising results along the way.
And always dealing with the correlation causation problem.
Exactly. So correlation doesn't equal causation, I always say, as everyone knows. But what we can say out of this analysis is what we have found is that a lot of the livability factors have a negative correlation. So things like housing affordability, air quality, unemployment rate, those things that we would have often considered table stakes, commute time, these are all very desirable goals, and we should continue to pursue them to make our cities as livable as possible. But we shouldn't expect, based on our research, that the outcome of those achievements to lead to prosperity for the community. So that's, I think, probably been one of the biggest insights.
That's exactly what Vancouver does.
Yeah, no question. And again, that's where we have to sort of separate and think about, yes, livability is important, and Vancouver's excelled in that. And we
should continue to pursue that. Our plan is called that. Livable region plan.
Absolutely. And that's a great goal and an objective for every community to pursue, but we shouldn't expect prosperity to come as a result of that.
Chris Fair, we sure do. That's exactly what we expect. Are you telling us that, well, maybe not that it's wrong, but one thing actually doesn't lead to the other?
Exactly. And that's where, again, where we can say causation doesn't equal correlation, but we can also say livability does not equal prosperity based on some of the research and analysis.
Well, what do we have to do about that?
So going back to those factors of what we do, where we do, again, correlation doesn't equal causation, but there's a relationship, a strong relationship in all of the benchmarking that we've done between what we would characterize as the vibrancy of the city, or what I like to call the lovability of the city. When you say, I love Paris or I love New York, it's not because of the housing affordability or the time to commute to work. It's about the restaurants or the culture or the nightlife or the museums. So it is these characteristics that we might be commonly considered to be nice to haves in a city. In our research, we're starting to look at as these might be needs to have to be one of those superstar cities in the 21st century.
Is this true all up and down the income scale?
In terms of attracting talent of varying...
Well, and service workers and people who want to raise families want to be in a safe place. All these factors go into it. I can hear the criticism, yes, museums and cultural amenities synonymous with those who can afford it. But is it also true as you go down the scale by age as well, younger people starting out?
I mean, we haven't parsed the results to, you know, based on demographic, et cetera, but I think that does speak to, you know, quality of life. Housing affordability obviously is more important to people that are younger or of lower income. So, you know, I'm not advocating, it's not an either or situation of thinking about livability versus lovability. You know, ideally it's both that we think that we need to be thinking about and pursuing to be a successful city in the 21st century.
And the correlation must be direct to tourism as well. People want to go to lovable places.
Yeah, and I think that's obvious, right? I think what we're uncovering now is that the relationship between those factors and investment and job creation.
Well, does lovability for tourism equal the cliches, what you see still on the posters, the beaches, the nightlife, all of those factors? Is there something more happening out there?
Yeah, I think those things are obvious on the surface. You know, I use Vancouver as a great example of the Awesome Alley project behind our office on Hastings Street. So the Downtown Vancouver BIA created a vision for downtown Vancouver, and part of that vision was to reclaim some of the public spaces with the alleyways that take up 30% of the public space. And they painted that alleyway pink, and they've activated that alleyway, but you know, that's now become one of the most Instagram places in all of Vancouver. And you think about in the city with the urban design and the buildings and everything that we have, that is an example where it's not a beach, it's not a mountain, it's an alley that's been painted pink. So there are different things now that resonate with visitors, and that also creates opportunities to create a variety of different types of experiences that are probably less formal than the way we've thought about urban design in the past.
Got some other examples from other places?
I mean, Montreal is a great example of their projecting images and historical history in the wintertime onto buildings so that you're able to walk around the city and learn about the history through these projections. So I think there are a variety of examples, and Copenhagen has done some great placemaking around activating in some poorer neighborhoods. And I think that was an interesting one when you look at the Super Killen Park, that was designed in the northern part of the city, lower class neighborhood. But when I was in Copenhagen, that drew me to that neighborhood and, you know, spending money in the restaurants, et cetera. And I think that is one of the opportunities as well of thinking about how do we distribute the benefits and the economic impact of tourism to a greater, wider parts of the city, not just the downtown core.
Well, that's what tourists do, isn't it? They spread it around.
Hopefully, if it's done well.
Do you take these skills and apply them to what we just think of as more traditional urban planning? Are you always the creative consultant over there?
And we're working now with some planners in partnership. We're just in the finalist with Broadway Mallion in London to create an urban plan for Island in Abu Dhabi. So looking at how we're bringing our data and benchmarking to be able to help inform and looking and saying, well, what makes a successful, vibrant waterfront in Sydney or in Barcelona, and how do we then lay that over to undo a gap analysis to understand what types of activities and experiences. So informing the urban plan by identifying the ingredients that are key to the outcome that we're looking to achieve. So I think that's quite a disruptive approach to urban planning versus what planners would typically do, you know, of just going in there and identifying what does the site accommodate based on the constraints that are offered.
But you're safe. You can go into the boardroom at the highest levels of executive decision-making. They're comfortable with a guy like you. You're giving them data, and you're explaining it in the words that they understand. Or, again, am I exaggerating?
I mean, that's certainly how we like to position ourselves, absolutely, of providing a different point of view.
Well, then, aren't you one of those guys who's out there homogenizing the world?
I think in that particular case, when you're looking at the benchmark, that's not to say that we're trying to replicate Sydney or Barcelona in Abu Dhabi. It's really trying to identify what are the ingredients. Is it nightlife? Is it culture? What are the types of components? And then that's where the planning comes in to say, well, how do we localize that? What's the right interpretation of nightlife? It could be quite different than Barcelona or Sydney Harbor or Singapore, and it will be quite different. So I think that's marrying what are the lessons that we can learn, you know, from these general categories of experiences, and then localizing them to what's appropriate to the audience and the community that this particular place plans to serve.
Even as that local becomes more global.
And I think that is, I mean, we've looked at, and we talk about this a lot, that, you know, globalization has created a bit of a homogenization of place. When you look around and you walk off the plane and you go into the downtown business district in Singapore, you'll see the same stores that you see on Alberni Street in Vancouver, you know, or in London or New York.
And you'll hear some of the same slang.
Yeah, absolutely. But there is a counter trend to that. And, you know, if I put my futurist hat on, there's always a counter trend to every trend. And I think we really are seeing an emerging counter trend to globalization with a demand and an interest in more local experiences, more local goods, more local tours. And you look at what Airbnb is doing with now creating a platform for locals to offer unique guided tours and experiences in their city, not just homes, that the future is going to begin to look at those cities that are able to offer not the same as everyone else, but something different, are going to have a competitive advantage because that's what the marketplace is going to begin to pursue.
Well, this is exactly where indigenous culture, economy comes into it, doesn't it?
In this particular part of the world, yeah, absolutely. That is a strong differentiating characteristic. We worked on a tourism master plan for Vancouver going back six, seven years ago, and indigenous tourism, you know, was a key potential area that could be developed both from an interest point for locals and for visitors. But that has to be led by, you know, First Nations communities, and we can support and partner with them, but that's not something that we could mandate.
Have you seen a place in the world that is doing exactly what you're suggesting, making the local more, well, global?
Yeah, I think a great example is Copenhagen. We've done some work with them and did our experiential benchmarking for them, and they've just come out with a project called 10X of how do they make Copenhagen 10 times what it is, what makes it different. And they've coined a term called localhood, and they're actually abolishing the term tourists and looking at that when you're here, you're visiting as a local, and we want you to have a local hood experience. And so this is really is about identifying what makes Copenhagen Copenhagen and amplifying that rather than trying to attract the same things that everyone else has.
Back to your hometown, you actually had a chance or are doing work for Calgary?
Yeah, Calgary, having grown up there, I left when I was 17, but had the opportunity in 2007. We were engaged first through, actually, it was a resort development outside of Calgary, and that developer moved to go work for the city for a new organization called the Calgary Municipal Land Corporation that was charged with revitalizing East Village. And East Village was the eastern part of downtown next to City Hall. It was actually the area where Calgary began, next to Fort Calgary. But over time, it had become abandoned largely. It was home to only a few senior towers, drop-in centers, and Salvation Army, et cetera. So the goal was, you know, how to revitalize and attract investment back into this particular area. And that was really one of our very first urban projects. And it was certainly, for me, having grown up in Calgary, when I first got the phone call about this project, I didn't know in my mind where East Village was. You know, as Calgarians, we had literally deleted this place from our minds, and it didn't exist within the fabric of the city. And yet it sits right downtown, between downtown Fort Calgary and St. Patrick's Island. So we've now been working there for over a decade, first starting with helping shape that vision, taking the approach that we had originally developed with helping to think about resort development and applying that to create a vision for what the future experience in East Village could be. That moved on to creation of a master plan that articulated how that vision could be realized.
Classic urban planning stuff.
Classic urban planning stuff. And then our role of attracting investment to the to prospective developers. And interestingly, no Calgary developers were takers in the initial round. It was developers from Vancouver and Toronto that could see that opportunity because they weren't blinded, as blinded by the past and the bad history with that particular neighborhood. Since that time now, they've attracted more than $2.7 billion of investment. There's the new National Music Center for Canada's there. Condominiums, apartments, new hotels have been built, and most recently, the new Central Library just opened up a few months ago.
Which is stunning. And I haven't even been there. I'm just going by the pictures and what I've heard.
Yeah, the new Central Library, I think designed by Snoetta, along with Dialogue from here in Vancouver and Calgary, is a great example of what, as we talked about earlier, what is the role of the library in the 21st century, that it's not just a place for books, but it is that gathering place for the community. And we've been overwhelmed in looking at just the number of people from the suburbs of Calgary that are now coming downtown because of that facility. Obviously, there's some novelty when a new facility opens, but we think the design of this particular place really will see that it'll be a community gathering place, a center for creativity for decades to come.
If I asked you to make the argument or give me insight into the investments in things like libraries, education, public services, could you actually give me a number, a letter grade, a dollar investment, something that would take it just beyond, oh yeah, right, sounds maybe possible, but until you can quantify it, I can't really believe.
I mean, I think we can look at not so much what's the return on the investment for that particular building, but what happens around that within a neighborhood or citywide context. You know, our conversation here around the Vancouver Art Gallery, you know, and is that an investment that we should be making? I mean, if you looked at what is the return on that investment just from a financial perspective, would be very difficult to ascertain.
I want a number.
But I don't think that should be our expectation of those kinds of investments. It should be centered really more around the vibrancy, vitality, you know, of the city. And I think that those kinds of investments shouldn't be quantified based on a dollar perspective, but have to be part of that broader strategy of what are we doing to make this a culturally vibrant, relevant city in the 21st century that will attract the talent and the jobs and the companies that will then help support the creation of further investments in cultural infrastructure and public amenities.
Your job, your career, what you're good at, is to give a narrative which fits in. I gather everything from data from users, to corporate strategies with a vision of the future. It's a great job. But I'm wondering how it goes back to that creative writing course. Are you very far away from actually, in a sense, writing that novel?
I guess we are writing the stories of places. And, you know, my partner is actually, her title is Vice President of Storytelling. She's a much better writer than I ever could hope to be. And that's why I partnered with her when we created Resonance. And that, to this day, is one of the differentiating factors of our company, of having the data, the research, the strategy, the insights, but then being able to translate and communicate that in a manner that resonates with, as we like to say, with the people that that we work with, is part of the key to our success of marrying the logic with a bit of magic.
Don't give up on that novel, Chris.
We'll keep on writing the stories, hopefully for more and more places, chapter by chapter.
And we'll have you back. Thanks for the time you gave us.